You're wrong with Ian and Bobby. You're wrong.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to You're Wrong with Ian and Bobby, a podcast where we talk about popular culture. I'm Bobby, and our titular wrong is Ian. Today, we're going to be discussing the popular indie video game Undertale. But first, how's it going, Ian?
I'm good, man. That was pretty good. I like that. So we're going to start with what we've been doing lately. I have a couple of things I want to talk about, although I think we're going to have either a quick spoilers warning or talk about these things spoilers free, because there are two big things that are going on in pop culture right now. Of course, Avengers Endgame just came out, which both of us have seen, and Game of Thrones is in its final season, both of which I'm enjoying immensely. I wanted to maybe talk about Endgame a little bit, but what do you think? Do you think we should avoid spoilers still? This probably isn't coming out for another week. I imagine everyone in the world will have seen it by then. What did you think of Endgame?
I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah, because you were not as high on the on Infinity War as I was.
That's true. I would say I in hindsight, you know, with a year and with the second half of it essentially having come out, I'm comfortable saying I didn't like Infinity War, but I enjoyed Endgame quite a bit. It's like not a perfect movie by any means, but it just hit all of the right nostalgia kind of feels for me.
Yeah, it's just so fun. And I think, you know, I've used this phrase a lot. It's such a, like, cool victory lap for the series. They get to, I mean, like, more than any other, you know, we've talked a lot about the kind of Marvel formula and, like, the injecting a little bit of fun into this. This felt at times more like a comedy in the first half of it than an action movie in a good way. And then it's, you know, everybody's complaining about this 3-hour thing, but that's because we got an hour to, you know, have the biggest fight scene in the history of Marvel. And it's, I don't know, everything about it just felt really good to me. I liked it a lot. It reminded me of the comics events that I love. It also, I was curious, did it make you like Infinity War anymore? Because it kind of set up some of the interesting character arcs that our heroes are reaching in their final moments, or like, what were your thoughts on that kind of stuff?
I think if anything, it made me like Infinity War less. And I think where Endgame really works for me, where Infinity War didn't, is I think Thanos as presented by the MCU is like not a great character. I don't particularly like or understand him. Sure. I think Josh Brolin's performance is really interesting.
Yeah.
But
I will. Can I counter that really quick? And then let you move on, because I have thoughts on that.
Sure.
I hear that a lot, and I don't disagree. I think that Thanos is a pretty one-dimensional character. However, as a comic book fan and as a fan of events, I do like the big DC and Marvel events when they're done well. I think that's sometimes what's called for in a situation like this. I mean, you have like 20 main characters, even in the second one, where it's focusing on the original team a lot more. And I think it's really fun to have Thanos just be this kind of ominous, dark side, kind of unstoppable force. You know, he has this, like, line that he keeps using in the movie that I am inevitable. And I like that. I like that he's just somebody who is trying to kill a lot of people who they can't stop. They're not good enough to beat him. And to see, like, the Marvel heroes put into that position and deal with the ramifications of it, I liked a lot. So I think for me, Thanos was a good tool to use in this particular story, because the villain's not really the point for me. I mean, like, if you put like a Joker scene-stopping villain performance in this movie, like, that's not what this story calls for.
Right, and what you're describing is Endgame and not Infinity War. And so I totally agree on that front.
Right.
I think the fact that we're forced to like endure so much of Thanos's Thanos's presence in Infinity War, and he doesn't really have any meaning or relationship with most of our heroes, and you know, the one character he kind of does have
I think
predetermined relationship.
I think
with.
You can give Infinity War spoilers at this time.
No, but I was gonna say nobody really knows or cares about who Thanos is.
Right.
Except for Gamora and Nebula. And that is sped through so quickly in Infinity War that it becomes sort of problematic, I think. But I really like in Endgame that, yes, he's there. He's won. He's powerful. But he's also essentially a plot device. Like,
he's absolutely. I mean, I'm fine with him being a plot device, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, I think here's what I think about the Gamora and Nebula stuff too. I think that's been going on since the beginning of their story. We just haven't seen it happen in a room with Thanos. So like, all we know about them is that they're basically sisters who were raised by an abusive dad. And like, that's kind of all you need to know how their dynamic works. And then we see the two of them have that dynamic for 2.5 movies before we get to Infinity War. I don't know. I was fine with all of it.
I think the film language asks us to see Thanos as like an emotionally complex person.
I think in Infinity War, that's true. I like that they don't do any of that in this. Yeah.
No, he's just a big evil asshole.
Yeah. I think, what's the planet called? Vormir?
Yeah.
I think the scene we have in Vormir is probably my only part of Infinity War I didn't really care about. It's just kind of like a lazy plot device. And it's about 10 minutes long and it doesn't really make any sense. And they don't really ask us to care if it makes any sense. And then they just do the exact same thing in this movie. And they spend about the exact same amount of time on it, which is like a 15-minute scene. And it's just not really necessary.
I like to call it the Soul Stone vending machine.
Yeah, that's a good one. But yeah, I think the ramifications of the scene in both movies was something I didn't like, and it was something that felt like a disservice to the characters it was done to because it wasn't necessary. Like it just wasn't well thought out.
I agree.
It's really my only beef with either one. I will say though, like, Jesus, this movie like gets to have everything by the end of it. Like everybody keeps saying, you know, oh, don't go to the bathroom. It's 3 hours, but you got to stay the whole time. And like, that's not totally true. There's moments that are just kind of fun little romp stuff. But I like stick around for the last hour because the movie does some really, really fun stuff by the end of it.
About the 3 hour thing, people are talking about Endgame as though it's the first, as though Avengers invented the 3 hour movie.
Yeah, which exactly.
Is bullshit. Like, yeah. We've had plenty of 3 hour movies and we haven't done this like bathroom guide bullshit before. A lot of the, if you are for some reason doing the stupid bathroom break guide, a lot of them are putting on their like list of things where a list of moments where you can, where you can take a bathroom break, a conversation between Tony and Pepper in the first act that I think is one of the best scenes in the movie.
I agree.
Like, actually very crucial.
I think anything involving Tony you should stick around for. This is his movie and he gets to shine in it.
My biggest worry going into the third act of this movie, and I'm going to try to speak without spoilers, is that, you know, I just made my opinions on Thanos pretty well known. And my thought in the theater was like, Thanos isn't worthy of, We know contracts are up, you know, we know it's the last movie for like
the meta gaming aspect of this is we know that this is going to be the end. It's called the end game.
Right. I mean, so I'm like, this is lame because Thanos isn't worthy of ending any of these characters.
Right.
And then the way that some of these exits
should have been Whiplash. I always really liked Whiplash. He would have been a good final villain.
I agree.
The universe.
No, yeah. I mean, if they're going to, a lot of nostalgia is milked in this movie, and I was missing a cameo from Mickey Rourke. So, I'm kidding, but no, I think the way that the major franchise exits were handled are uniformly beautiful.
I agree.
Just really, really good.
I agree. I have one. Actually, I disagree with one, but you're right for the most part.
One of them, I agree with you on the one I think you're talking about, but I also don't think that's an exit, so.
Interesting.
Wait, hang on. Can I pause real quick?
Sure.
Are you talking about
Yes. Yeah, I know, but is it gonna be
Yeah.
Oh, okay, then never mind. Then yeah, okay. I'm stupid.
We'll unpause now.
Okay. You're gonna have to do a lot of editing.
I love editing, man. This is probably the last episode of You're Wrong with Ian and Bobby, so why not go out with a bang?
Yeah, that's true. The other thing, is there anything else you wanted to say about Endgame?
No, it's good. It's a big old mess, but it's a really nice big old mess.
I don't think it's a mess. I think it's an intentional mess, and it's a fun mess. I like it. I like it a lot. I think you know, something I've talked to a couple of people about is that my favorite thing about these events is that they say goodbyes, but they also set up the new status quo, the new world. And I'm excited for where these movies go next. It looks like some fun stuff is going to happen.
There's apparently a Spider-Man trailer landing tomorrow that will have major spoilers in it
for Endgame. Oh, for Endgame. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. I'm excited to see where we go next. I think we could talk. Well, actually, no. Never mind. I'm trying to figure out what I want to talk about and what is spoilery, and I feel
it's
like
funny because we're sidestepping spoilers. And full disclosure, I was just a complete asshole to Ian and made him redo something he said to admit.
You
weren't
an asshole. I think you're right. I don't
care
about spoilers.
Like,
it
doesn't take a month to edit this podcast, and everyone will have seen this movie by then.
That's my thought. Also, I just don't care. I don't care about spoilers as much as other people. If we start talking about something that people don't want to hear, they should just turn the podcast off or skip ahead 5 minutes. Like, I think that's fine. I think that's totally reasonable to call for. I don't know.
I hate spoiler culture. Like, I actually hate it.
Yeah.
I think there's certain things where it's like, okay, we shouldn't talk about major plot points. One of my friends was listening to our Steven Universe episode, and then he sent me a string of angry texts about how we spoiled Steven Universe stuff, and I'm like, did we? I didn't think we were that spoilery on that.
We were not very specific. We talked about some character arcs, but that's, yeah. The other thing I wanted to talk about this week was Game of Thrones. We're three episodes in. The fourth one is airing tonight. There are going to be six total for this final season. What are your thoughts on the season so far? Are you enjoying it?
I'm going to be a little more of a Debbie Downer on this one.
Yeah. I got this sense because I've texted you about it a couple of times and you really didn't say much. I will preface our whole conversation here by saying I think I'm going to disagree with you. I really, really like the third one a lot, but... yeah,
I like how we're killing the premise of our You're Wrong theming of our podcast.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, we right out of the gate just start disagreeing on things.
I mean, we always disagree on things, Bobby. It's just minor things. But yeah, what are your thoughts on the season?
I'm going to start with a caveat and say, sure, I don't know where the season's going. So I could be wrong. I might change my mind this week, today. Mm-hmm. Who knows? The third... And I don't mind going full spoilers because TV is a lot different than film. But we had a big battle in the third episode of Game of Thrones in which the White Walkers finally descend on Winterfell, where most of our heroes are assembled.
Yeah, I agree.
And that ends with our heroes seemingly defeating the White Walkers. The end. And I... don't know how I feel about that. I think the White Walkers really need to mean something more than just, like, the mini-boss on the way to the Iron Throne, especially since they are, like, the looming existential threat throughout the entire series. And so I'm a little worried that my problem with the recent Game of Thrones mm-hmm. has been... And I'm speaking as someone who was not a huge fan of the books.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they ran out of source material, Benioff and Weiss, and I thought this would be a good thing, kind of were able to feel free to start tying things up.
Sure.
But then they started cranking the plot wheel a lot, and things don't necessarily matter thematically. And I worry that that is what's happening right now.
I've had those thoughts. I will say I really liked the third episode, and... although I understand the qualms you have with the way it ended, that it seems like the White Walkers are done, I'm fine with that, too. I don't need a 4-hour-and-a-half special effects movies about these characters fighting zombies. That doesn't sound fun to me.
No, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying what did the White Walkers mean to the narrative?
That's where I do agree with you. However, I also, I want to see what happens to this world, and I'm interested to see, You know, like, I think in a lot of ways, the White Walkers were a plot device to kind of force, to cut through the bullshit of politics and power struggle that is the show. And it was the first opportunity we have for all these characters to kind of come together. And now they can set their sights on King's Landing. I don't know. It seems fun to me. I'm into it. I agree. Also, I get what you're saying. It feels a little fast and loose. But, I mean, what did you expect them to do? They're making it up as they go along now.
Well, they shouldn't be making it up as they go along, is, I think, one thing. But I do think that there's the possibility that another shoe's going to drop with the White Walkers. Like, something weird happened with Bran. You know, there's a moment in the battle where a dragon, you know, pours fire onto the Night King, mm-hmm. and the Night King doesn't burn, and so maybe there's a tie between the Night King and the Targaryens, which is something that Daenerys might have to grapple with. I see ways in which the White Walkers as like an idea could still mm-hmm. continue. There's a chance for that to be resolved in a more interesting way, I think.
Well, don't forget also that the White Walkers originally were created
by the Children of the Forest.
As a way to fight, right? As a way to like protect yeah. themselves. So like I do see like yeah, I think we might like I don't know. I get what you're saying. I agree with you, but it was just a really cool fight. I liked it a lot. I mean, as a standalone episode, it was incredible. I kind of started getting mad at all the people who were complaining about how dark it was. I watched it at night with the lights off, and it was fine. Like I thought it was a really pretty, really really well directed episode, and it really impressed me in the same way as something like Battle of the Bastards did, which is, I mean, I think one of the best action scenes ever filmed on television, and this kind of stood up on that same level for me. I thought Lady Mormont, her moments in the show were awesome, and Jorah's were awesome, and I don't know. I really like what they're doing this season with... It's funny we're talking about this right after Endgame, because I feel like it's kind of doing a similar thing, which is you have like 300 characters now. We like them all. Let's just keep putting them in rooms together. Where they think they're about to die. Like, that's the entire second episode was essentially
the second episode's
that.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
really
and it was great. I that was what made it amazing, is they just put all these people in rooms, gave them an absolutely incredible existential fear of death, and then let them talk to each other. And that was really, really cool to me. Like, that didn't require writing in terms of world building and plot structure. It just required love for the characters, and I thought it was great. So I don't know. I'm enjoying the season.
There's an interesting through line so far in this season, which there's a chance of it being unintentional, but I'm pretty sure it's intentional, which is that Daenerys has kind of assumed power of, you know, the quote unquote good guys.
Sure.
You know, the people we're rooting for.
Yeah.
And she kind of sucks at it in that, like, you realize, like, oh, leaders are like... monarchs are bad. Like, kings and queens
right.
are bad as a concept.
Well, and what we saw at the beginning of the show is that with Robert, like, conquerors and rulers are not necessarily the same skill set or even the same thing. And
right.
she has been a conqueror through the show. I mean, her biggest failures have been in rule.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the idea that we're pushing... I think a lot of people are looking at the rest of the series as like a thrust to unseat Cersei and install Daenerys as queen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, there's no way that this series can end with like a supposed benevolent ruler on the throne. Like, the series has to end with the throne being destroyed
monarch
getting destroyed.
I will say the thing I'm worried this series is leading towards, which I would hate, is Jon versus Daenerys.
Yeah, especially since I think we're a little late in the series to give a shit about bloodlines, you know? Like,
yeah,
if he's
yeah.
the blood ruler of the throne, and especially since he doesn't want it, I feel like it's the only conflict now is the incest conflict. Like,
yes, I agree.
No one's... I mean, maybe but, Sansa...
I just mean I'm more worried that she's gonna... They're trying to, like, set up a way that Daenerys becomes the bad guy, and I
yeah.
really don't want that. I think that's... I think, I mean, I get what you're saying about the benevolent leader. I think that's also an easy answer, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, Daenerys is the bad guy. That's the thing.
Daenerys isn't the bad guy.
She's the iron-fisted ruler with like weapons of mass destruction at her immediate control.
Who frees slaves everywhere she goes?
You know what is a
and trusts good people.
You know what's unfortunate about the way that the world was built is that the people of color in the series are the natural good fighters. So they're the front lines of the battle, and they just get mowed down.
Well, Melisandre isn't. She's safe.
Missandei.
Melisandre's the other one.
Yeah, the Dothraki are just gone.
Yeah.
Then it looked like the Unsullied guy hit pretty hard too.
Yeah, I did see a lot of memes after the second episode came out where it was just
South Park.
No, Grey Worm and what's her name again? Missandei.
Missandei.
Missandei, Grey Worm and Missandei walk, you know, riding their horses into Winterfell and just like wide-eyed, like people are just riding underneath it. Jesus, there's a lot of white people here.
reminded me of South Park, the movie, like the Operation.
Yes.
Where they put all the black people in front.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that. Well, what about you? Anything you've been up to lately that you want to talk about? Those were my two big ones.
Yeah, I have two things. The first one is a podcast that I recently discovered called Lost Notes. And it's like a musical, it's a music documentary podcast. And it's really interesting. The first episode is especially good. And it's about the origin and life of the song Louie Louie.
Okay.
And
the song that is famous for no one having any idea what the lyrics are.
Yeah, and it has kind of like an interesting tragic story of, you know, a person of color writing that song and then like a group of white kids popularizing it.
Sure.
But things I learned in that podcast that will change me forever. The Kingsmen were this like dopey group of high school kids who just really wanted to be rock stars. And so they got studio time and recorded Louie Louie. And they didn't know what they were doing. So the guy was singing into the wrong part of the microphone, which is why you can't understand him. There's a part in the song where he comes in for like a measure and then stops and then like comes in again. And I always thought that was weird. But it turns out he literally just came in early and then and then stopped and then came back in again. And they just didn't record it. They thought they were going to re-record it. That was their first take. And then the studio manager's like, nah, you're fine. And then there's a moment where the drummer drops one of his drumsticks and yells "fuck" really loudly, and it's on the track. Like you can hear this guy in the background just shout "fuck," and it's awesome. So I've heard that song hundreds of times.
Basically, you found a real life podcast version of that thing you do.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are so many fucks in that thing you do. But it's really good. I listened to another one about the, I don't know if you remember these.
What's the podcast called again?
It's Lost Notes.
Lost Notes. Okay.
There's another episode about the McDonald's in the late 80s, I think, put out these little Plexi records, that you could play on your record player. They looked like postcards and it was the McDonald's menu song. But if, But on one of the millions of records they shipped out, they like the recording was different, and the person who got that Plexi won $1 million.
Oh my god!
And so they find the guy who won $1 million as a kid, and like they kind of like drop in on his life and talk about what's happened since then, and it's really interesting and really sad. Really interesting and really sad. Yeah, I was
going to say, he's probably had a really, really good life. That usually is what happens when people win tons and tons of money when they're very young.
That's how I would describe the entire podcast. It's really interesting, really sad. And then also, I've been listening the last couple of days to a musical soundtrack, to a musical called Hadestown. Yeah. Anais Mitchell wrote it, and it took her like 12 years, I guess, to get it onto Broadway.
Wow.
But it's the story of Orpheus and Eurydice from Greek mythology.
Yeah,
but it's kind of grafted onto
That is the man who goes down to hell to save his wife and then turns around and looks at her right before they leave, so she can't go, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And it's told through through American folk music.
Okay.
And like the aesthetic is very American folk. Like Persephone rides a train, like on a railroad out of Hadestown.
Huh. Okay.
Once a year, you know, and then she spends her 6 months above ground and then goes back down to Hadestown for the other six months.
You're definitely selling me. Greek mythology and folk music are two of my favorite things. So,
and some of those songs are just really good. And then, you know, there's just the built-in tragedy to that myth. I haven't seen it staged, but I've fallen in love with the soundtrack.
Orpheus is a demigod whose demigodness shows up in the form of he's a magically talented musician. So it sounds like it would be very applicable to a fun show anyway.
And the climax of the show where he plays a song for Hades to try to convince him to allow him to bring Eurydice back is really good. It's just a beautiful, beautiful song.
Heavy and hard is the heart of a king. King of iron, king of steel. The heart of a king loves everything like the hammer loves the nail.
And James Woods plays Hades, right?
James Woods plays Hades, yes.
Our favorite actor in Hollywood.
Yes. Recently office stint on Twitter. He is killing it in Broadway. You know what's actually kind of fun about the cast album that's out right now? I think they're going to do another one for the Broadway cast. Is that it's half of the cast is like half the cast from Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Like Orpheus is the guy who played Peter Parker.
I'm laughing because you're saying this like that means anything to me at all.
Oh, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is a
I understand what Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is. I'm just saying, like, I know nothing about any of the cast of that show at
all. It's just fun. I was looking up the cast and I'm like, oh, this is the cast of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
They're still alive? I heard
The guy who plays Orpheus was Spider-Man. He has to do most of the show in a wheelchair. because of the injuries he sustained. But yeah, no, it's really good. Right. So
that sounds cool.
Yeah, Hadestown, it rocks. That's the marketing headline for Hadestown is it rocks.
It rocks.
Yeah,
I don't get it.
Yeah, it's just a bad marketing headline. I'm not a comedian, Ian.
Oh, I thought you were saying that was real. Sorry. No. I'm sorry. I was trying to figure out what reference to the myth that was making, and
I think there's no more like deflating and horrifying thing is after you crack like not a great joke, someone pausing everything and going like, "Explain it to me."
Though, wait, I'm sorry.
You're just like I don't. I didn't realize
you were making a joke.
I want a time machine. That's what I want.
Well, make better jokes, man. I don't know what to tell you. No. Yeah. Okay. No, that sounds really cool. I'm very interested in that. Last thing I want to talk about just really briefly, is I want to talk about the DC Universe app. I am really into it. The reason I brought it up is because there are four or five shows I'm watching on it now, but also they just put up the entire digital, comic book archive of everything they have on there. So I've been reading old comics and it's a cheap, easy, app to use, and if you like superhero stuff, you should check it out. There's a lot of good programming on there. Bobby is sighing because I actually like the Titans show where Robin in the trailer for the season unfortunately says fuck Batman in a gravelly voice, and he's been making fun of me for it ever since. But it's actually a good show, and Doom Patrol is good, and Young Justice season 3 is good, and there's a million comics on there, and they're putting out some interesting stuff. So
I didn't know that the comic archive wasn't already on there.
It's only been up. They only put it up a couple of weeks ago. They have some stuff on there, but it was mostly tied to
like show releases. You know, they would put up Doom Patrol when Doom Patrol came out and stuff, but then they just decided to release the whole thing on there, and it's great.
I have just started reading the Wonder Twins, and it's great.
So, ooh, highly that's recommend. DC. I didn't even think about that. I can totally read that on there.
Okay. It's really very good. Yeah. I also was reading Power Rangers and the DC Universe crossover, and that was the pretty fun too.
Justice League Power Rangers.
Yeah,
you've had that for like 3 years. You're just getting around to it.
I don't own a physical copy of it.
I thought you did. I thought I was reading it once and it was in your car or something.
No, I own the Power Rangers comic book, which I got 1 year ago on Free Comic Book Day.
Okay, but, okay.
Yeah. Good stuff, well, man.
Should we jump into our pick for the day?
Yeah, our pick for the day, as we have affectionately called it for our entire run of the podcast.
Are you making fun of me for this?
I am.
What do you want to call it, Bobby? Just call it whatever you want. Bobby's stupid fucking choice. That's what this episode is called now.
My thing is better than your thing.
So last time I edited, and in the editing of the podcast, I realized I talked a lot. Mostly because I was talking about things you hadn't seen yet in Avatar The Last Airbender. But I thought I would try to take a big step back and give you a chance to talk for a while before I jump in any way about your choice for this time. So why don't I shut up and let you get started?
You make the false assumption that what I want is to talk the whole time and not to have a balanced conversation.
Well, you're right. A balanced conversation is good, but I would say last time I think I spoke for about 20 minutes without you really adding much, and I felt very strange about that. So I want to make up for that time.
So this week we're going to be talking about an indie RPG called Undertale.
The game came out it's available where?
It's available everywhere now, okay. I think, except for like mobile. But it came out a few years ago as a PC-only game and has slowly over the course of the past year, I think, started trickling onto systems. So now I think it's on PS4, Xbox, and Switch. I don't see why there isn't a reason it couldn't be on like 3DS also.
Right.
Or even mobile. But the aesthetic is very 16-bit. It's like a very kind of sparse Super Nintendo looking game. And it kind of, I said before, and then you, forgetting that I said it, agreed with me that it borrows the aesthetic of like of Earthbound.
Yes, it does.
Clearly. And so the story of the game is pretty simple. The world you're dropped into is you're this kid who falls down a hole into the world of monsters, and the world of monsters and humans are at odds with each other. And so you're this kid trying to make your way out of the world of monsters and into the world of humans, and you are sort of given a choice of how you want to, you know, how you want to proceed through this world. If you want to be violent and fight your way out, or if you want to do your best to be a pacifist, or if you kind of just want to play through how you want to play through. Mm-hmm. But the thing I really enjoy about Undertale is it kind of is whatever you bring to it, which sounds kind of lofty and kind of like a vague, silly thing to say about it. But I'm really impressed with how the game kind of shapes around how you specifically decide to work your way through the world.
I agree. I think that that does sound like kind of vague and lofty and philosophical, but it does feel that way. It feels like a game that you can kind of, basically every encounter is either a fight or a kind of puzzle where you have to like figure out what this creature needs from you emotionally, essentially, to get past it, to befriend it or to calm it down or to trick it into running away or whatever it is that specific situation calls for.
Also, the something to point out, the main character is, you can pick if you identify as male or female or neither, but you, but there's only one sprite that you play as. It's essentially a gender neutral avatar character, which I thought was interesting. And the enemies don't ever refer to you as anything other than kid or using gender neutral pronouns. So you can kind of, I think you're right in saying that the game like invites you to project your stuff onto it.
Yeah. And I remember I sort of, when we were talking about it a couple of weeks ago, I sort of, I think, presented a false binary of what I had heard about the game, which is like, you have the option of being a pacifist, or you have the option of killing everything. And
well, you do.
But I think the game really just wants you to play, at least the first time through, just play however you feel like playing through it, you know? Yeah. It wants you to bring your genuine self to the game. And part of the, part of what's really impressive and interesting is how you kind of find your emotions challenged by certain things that happen in the game. And, you know, it's not quite, it's not totally simple. You know, like you were saying, each interaction is kind of a puzzle, but also some of the puzzles get really hard, and it's a lot easier to get through them, you know, by fighting your way through it.
I will say that I played through fairly passively, although I definitely killed things if I needed to. One of the interesting aspects of the game is that you get stronger if you fight, but you don't get any experience if you don't fight. So you don't level up, which means that the game gets harder to play pacifist. You have to be able to, basically, do you want to describe how you control the game? Cause it's, or how the combat works? Cause it's kind of hard to explain, but it's really cool. I liked it a lot.
So the combat, so it's your typical, random battle RPG where you walk around, a screen activates and then enemies appear in front of you.
Turn-based. It feels like, like we both said, it feels a lot like Earthbound, or if you haven't played that, very similar to the old school Pokemon games in terms of just general, like how everything, the engine, how the engine works.
Right. Yeah. And then when you, when the enemy attacks you, you go into, there's a mechanic called Bullet Hell, where a lot of things shoot at you, and you're represented usually by a little heart, and you move this heart around to try to dodge or avoid attacks, which can be very easy or very, very difficult, like absurdly difficult.
And each of the different types of monsters has different types of attack used in that space, so it's always, there's a lot of pattern learning and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, there was a... because I was trying to play through as a genocidal maniac the first time.
Yeah.
Which I'm glad I did not finish playing through that way.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
there was a boss fight that the fight mechanics were just like too hard for me.
Oh yeah. I looked a lot of these up online to see how the different versions of the fights would go down, and some of them are really, really insane. In a cool way. Like they feel like old, hard arcade games or Nintendo games or something, you know?
And then I even looked up, I'm like, am I doing something wrong? Like, is there a guide to get past this boss fight? And there was just always some asshole going like, we'll get good. And I'm like, oh, fuck you. But, and then I looked up what the final boss was going to be. And it's a character who you don't fight in the other two, or in any other playthrough. You only fight this character in a genocide run. And it just looked hard, and then I saw the YouTube video was like 20 minutes long, and I'm like, I'm not going to be able to do that. Like, I know I'm not good enough to do that, and so I just kind of bailed out, but I'm glad I did, because these characters are all really, the writing in this game is really, really good, and the characters are all really really endearing. Like, even, you know, even the bigger bads are interesting and
it's
complex.
It's a sweet, funny, fun game. I want to, before we talk about like what makes the story cool and the characters cool, because I think that is really true in this game, I want to say that one of the things that I think is really cool about the game is that how you play affects how people interact with you and what the story mm-hmm. happens to be. So the first playthrough, I actually played through, I didn't play through twice, but I started it and then I actually started it over because I, basically you fall down into this underworld where all the monsters are trapped. And the first person you meet is this woman named Toriel, who's this monster that looks kind of like a lady cow. She's like very cute looking. Most of the monsters are not actually scary looking. And she shows you around her house and tells you about where you are and all these things. And then you decide to kind of go out and start the game and she blocks your way. And I, couldn't figure out how to talk my way past her. So I started hitting her, because I thought, you know, maybe after a second or two of that, she would like something would change. Cause I kept saying I wanted to talk to her. Nothing was happening. And then, I hit her once and it was like a critical hit and she died. And then yeah. I played a little bit farther and people kept being so sad about it. People kept asking like where Toriel was. I felt and she died. Like when you kill these characters, they die in kind of sad ways. Like she was just right. this sweet lady who she wasn't trying to fight me. She was just trying to keep me from leaving. And so I restarted because I just didn't like that. And I mostly, you know, I killed some minor random encounter characters, but for the most part, I didn't kill any, actual, you know, bosses or anything. And then you get to the end of the game and it's very, very heavily suggested that Toriel is the king's wife. Mm-hmm. And he like does a lot of things for you because he's excited to reunite with his wife again. And it made me realize, oh, maybe that encounter can't happen the same way if you kill Toriel. And I know that, for example, the first time you play through, you killed a character that I didn't. And I went on a date with him afterwards, and he kept calling me and giving me advice, and characters would help me in specific ways. His brother would help me because I was good to him. So there's a lot, even though the game looks very simple and it is done in that kind of 16-bit style, there's a lot of narrative nuance to the game that comes from these choices you make in a way that's really cool. By the way, this is a $15 game. It's really cheap for what it is, and it's very, very fun. I would say it took me about probably 9 or 10 hours to beat the whole thing.
And from what I understand, it's largely the labor of love of one person. Like one person.
What's his name again? Fox.
Toby Fox.
Toby Fox, yeah.
He had some, you know, technical and design help from other people, but it seems to be mostly just his brainchild, and it's a pretty impressive thing.
I agree. It gets to be, it's really funny.
Yes.
I will say funny. It's a really, really funny game. In a bunch of different ways. Do you want to talk about, why don't you talk about for a few minutes? What are some things you really enjoy about the game?
I was going to say a large part of what I love about the game is encapsulated in a character whose name I'm forgetting right now, and it's killing me. There's a killer robot you meet in the third act.
Metaton?
Metaton.
I think that's how you say it.
Yes.
I've only seen these written down, so.
He's the rogue creation of Dr. Alphys.
Who is a kind of manic, murdery game show, or like a
cartoonishly
robot. Yeah, like basically like a TV host gone crazy.
Right, and so you keep, it's really funny because you'll like walk into a dark area and then the lights will flip on and you realize you're on a game show set and Metaton has created a game show to try to kill you. And so you have to figure out how to get out of this situation with Metaton.
Or a cooking show or...
Right. And then, very consistently hilarious. And then when it's time to finally, like, come to a head in, like, a boss battle with Metaton, it's very challenging. It's a very difficult boss battle.
Yes.
But it resolves really, sweetly and it's very goofy the way it resolves. I don't want to spoil too much, but like.
No, I agree.
But you know what I'm talking about? It's goofy, but like you kind of sit and look at it unfold and you're like, aw, you know?
This is one of those games. It reminds me of old games. Zelda doesn't specifically do this, but a lot of Nintendo games that look like Zelda do, where you like you go into an area. I just love the feeling of when you go to a new town in a game that's a top-down exploring game like this, and there's like a culture that you're entering. Mm-hmm. And so like you walk into this new town and there's all these monsters everywhere and all of them are in love with something called Metaton. They like are all talking about how sexy and cool he is. And then like you keep hearing about, and it's just like this block on wheels that like ask you robotic murdery trivia questions. And then after like you beat it, everybody reacts. Like it's just fun. I like that. I like the very silly kind of like, introduction to these small towns with weird things and these cartoony connections between them all. Like it does that bit where like they have their own, you know, they make jokes like, oh, Metaton's the most popular show in town. I think he even has like 12 or 13 viewers, you know, like everything's very small, but it feels like it's making fun of the real world in fun ways. And, very quirky kind of 16-bit humor. One of my favorite jokes early on, and it was really great. There's these two skeleton brothers who are, you know, they're not really bad guys. There aren't anybody, there's really nobody in this game who's supposed to be, like, evil. Like, even Metaton is very silly and clearly is malfunctioning in some way and, you know.
Or even Flowey has stuff going on, which I didn't expect.
We'll get to Flowey.
Yeah.
Is that how you say it? I thought Flowey. It was Flowey.
It's Flowey. It makes more sense.
Because he's a flower. I mean, yeah. Come on. But there's this great moment where you are talking to these two skeletons, and they keep saying how they're going to stop you and slow you down. And they're basically Wile E. Coyote. They just keep bumbling around you. And so you get to this area, and there's this big – the whole screen is filled with this bridge made of different colored tiles. And and the bigger skeleton, Papyrus, who's kind of the boss of this area, goes, okay, here's – I've given you like an insanely hard puzzle to beat. Each of these tiles does a different thing. If you stand on the green ones, you have to fight a monster. If you stand on the pink ones, they'll fall out. You'll fall through a hole unless you're facing south. If you stand on the blue ones, you have to walk from a blue one to a red one or you get electrocuted. And it gives you this like – super complex list of the tiles and how they pattern and which one does what and everything really, really fast. And then Papyrus goes, and just so you know, it's a completely randomized puzzle, so you can't even look it up online. And my heart's like sinking while I'm doing this. You know, I'm playing this game because I'm having fun, but also like I'm doing it for the podcast and it's like 11:30 at night and I wanted to get a little bit done. So it like kind of feels like homework and I'm just like, I don't want to do a puzzle right now. And so the tiles are start flickering different colors. It's randomizing. And then they all turn into red, which you can walk on safely and you just walk across it like a bridge. And Papyrus gets really pissed off that his randomized puzzle caused him to shoot himself in the foot. And it was just like a very funny, silly, dumb moment, like a fun fake out for gamers. And I don't know, there's a lot of that in this game. It's a lot of really funny meta humor.
Oh my gosh. I can tell you my favorite gag, which I don't think you got to.
Maybe not.
Is that there's a quest that gets, there's a little puzzle you can do that will get you something called
are you talking about the piano puzzle?
Yeah, it'll get you this. There's a piano up against a wall.
Uh-huh.
And then you in an adjacent room there's a melody that you hear, and then after you solve a puzzle, and then if you play that melody onto the piano, it'll open a door.
Okay.
And so when you walk through the door, there's a there's an orb, like a glowing orb on a pedestal. And so you walk over to pick up the orb. And a thing that you're constantly juggling in the game is limited inventory space.
Yes, yeah.
Because you have like a relatively small inventory.
You have eight things you can hold total. That includes weapons, armor, health, or items, you know, whatever, anything like that.
Yeah, so you're constantly, when you're picking up items and you don't have enough, it says you can't pick up this item because you don't have any inventory space.
Right.
And so you go to pick up this orb and it says, you can't pick up this item because you have too many dogs in your inventory. And then you go into your inventory and there's a dog in your inventory. And so you go to drop the dog and then this like adorable dog is like next to you. And then he jumps up onto the pedestal and absorbs the orb and then runs away. And then that's it. Like, you never find out what that orb is, but then in your inventory, you have a thing called dog essence, which ends up being really useful, because if you use dog essence, there's like a 1 in 10 chance it'll give you a healing item called Dog Salad, but like it just immediately seems like that whole thing was to give you an item called Dog Essence, whose only power is to fill your inventory with dog essence. Yeah. And it's just so goofy and so wacky. But just the image of this little dog jumping out of your inventory and grabbing this like this magical item and then running off with it, you're like, it's so funny.
There's, I think, like halfway through the game, there's this area where you're in a place with a lot of elevators, and so you have to like transfer between 5 or 6 different locations. And you get off the elevator at one point, and there's this little guy who looks like he's made out of fire, who's standing off to the side, who's very cute looking. And if you walk up to him, he tells you his name. And then he says, like, remember it for later. And then later, you see him in a different area, and if you walk up to him again, he goes, what's your name? And if you say it right, he just goes, ah, you defeated me. How did you do that? And that's it. There's nothing more to it than that. It's not a big puzzle. It's just a...
He doesn't even say that, right? He just goes, did you remember my name? And then if you click yes, he goes, oh, you defeated me.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is.
You don't even have to remember his name.
Yes. There's a lot of really funny things like that. There also is a lot of really good... So it's great because you don't know what matters and what doesn't. So, for example, like 20 minutes into the game, I walk through this area where there's a bunch of spider webs and there's these spiders hanging out on the walls. And there's a sign that says bake sale. And if you walk up to any of the spider webs, you can buy like donuts and things from them.
They're just healing items.
Yeah, they're just healing items. And so I bought a couple and I used them. And then I found out from you that there's this spider boss like in the last third of the game that's really hard, but you can just hand her one of the bake sale items and she'll free you. And I had used my items already and I looked it up and you can't actually go back to that location.
Nope.
So I started fighting the boss and it was really hard. And then I thought I was going to have to kill her because I thought that was the only way to get through. And then about halfway through the fight, it just took me longer. A spider comes up and tells her that he recognizes me as somebody who bought a donut from him earlier, and she lets me go. So I thought I had screwed up, and I kind of had, but I just had to do half the fight instead of the whole thing.
Right.
So like, there's a lot of little things like that where it just feels very. It feels very adventurous in a way where you're like, you're not sure what you're supposed to do, but it never makes you feel like you need to hoard things either because there's always a few options. There is a perfect pacifist run that you can do, and there is a perfect genocide run you can do. You kind of sold it to me as that being the point or whatever at the beginning, and then you kind of decided, well, you should play through it once without doing that and then play through it again. Maybe trying to do one of those. Do you want to talk a little bit more about why? Because I've only played through once, so I haven't done any of the extra stuff. It sounds like you have a little bit more than me. Do you want to talk about what any of that is or why?
Sure.
What you mean by that, I guess?
Well, I do think it's interesting when you replay the game, and I do recommend like playing the game again. It's interesting.
I intend to.
And it's not a super long game either once you know what you're doing. But the game will remember that you've played through it in kind of fun ways. Like in your first playthrough, you have the option of killing like the final antagonist.
Yes.
Or sparing him.
Which,
and no matter what.
Which, by the way, like it asks you 18 times because this final antagonist is like clearly the most monstrous, scary thing in the game. Most of the monsters in the game are very cute or like are clearly misunderstood in some way. This thing is like a demonic, terrifying monster, and it after you beat it, it starts saying like, "I'm going to come back. I'm going to kill your whole family." And the game just keeps asking you, "Do you want to spare it or do you want to kill it?" And you just have to keep saying "spare it" like a lot. And he keeps just saying, like, here's what I'm going to do to you. Here's what I'm going to do next. And you have to just keep... Like, it's hard. It's hard to...
It's very hard.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I cut you off.
No. And it's interesting because that character is already kind of meta as far as the game.
Definitely.
And so no matter what happens, that character either has a meltdown and leaves or, or is killed. And so he's also the first character you see in the game.
Yes.
And so you, when you restart the game, he's just not there.
Yeah.
Like, it's just empty. And I'm like, oh, interesting. And so as I'm playing through, and the second time I played through, I played it through as a complete pacifist.
Yes.
You know, like, Ian had mentioned, I had killed Papyrus.
I can't believe you did this. Papyrus was such an innocent soul. He was so misunderstood.
And his brother, you know, just kind of was like, I feel like we've met before, but I don't know why. Or he says something like, I'm getting weird vibes from you, and I can't totally put a finger on it.
Yeah, they trust you less if you played through badly the first time, right?
Something like that. It doesn't actually affect the game proper, but there's just a couple moments. Or like Toriel, I had killed the first time through, the character you had killed the first time you were playing through. Yeah. And when you go to talk, you have an option to talk to her in the middle of battle. The game said like you considered mentioning that you've seen her die, you've watched her die before. you think that would be a little too upsetting, and I'm like, whoa, that's interesting. I really truly don't want to ruin things, but the way everything kind of comes together with the complete pacifist playthrough, and the way that all ends, and the way all of the characters you've kind of come to know and love, come together at the end, is really, really nice. It's really kind of like heartwarming to watch. And things end a lot happier when you play through as a pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
And Flowey, who is the, who's the character we were talking about, who's kind of this like evil agent of chaos through most of it. He kind of has an interesting, happy, like as happy as he's going to get, happy ending.
Oh, interesting.
In the pacifist playthrough, and you kind of learn more about Flowey. But when you go to restart the game again, Flowey stops you and says, "Here's an idea. Like, we're all happy right now, and I can't imagine any scenario in which we're going to be as happy as this again. How about you not restart the game? And then this is all going to be gone, and none of us are going to remember it except for you." And then Flowey kind of has a moment where he goes, "Oh my god, you've probably done this many, many, many times before." And I just wasn't prepared for that. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry.
That's really funny.
But it's good. I mean, that I guess that was a spoiler, but there's
no,
little
minor.
Interesting.
I mean, I don't think this is a game. Like, I mean, I don't think this is a game where spoilers are super important. I think the character interactions and the kind of wackiness of the cast is what makes it fun. Why did you pick this one? Like, what was most impressive to you about this? I love this game, by the way. I'm not saying I did not.
Well, I'd only actually ever played until about a little after Papyrus. I didn't play that much of the game. I knew that this was a widely acclaimed game, that people for the most part have only had good things to say about this game. I'm going to, we're going to sound like, this is going to sound very cliche for either of us. I had kind of been spurred into it a couple months ago because someone had been talking to Film Critic Hulk on Twitter about video games. And someone had mentioned Undertale as being an overrated game.
Mm-hmm.
And Film Critic Hulk had responded with like, "Oh, no, I think Undertale is like one of the greatest like narrative achievements in video games ever."
I would agree with that. I think narratively it's really, really interesting and impressive. One thing we haven't really said, the monsters they're trapped underground, but they used to be on Earth with humans, and there's this kind of like Israel-Palestine thing between them. And the fact that the game does nothing to show them as monstrous, but they're called monsters. Like, I there's something interesting about that. I don't know exactly what I want to say about it, but it's just like the fact that there are no villains in this game. Really is kind of cool.
Well, and I think that's that revelation is part of what's interesting of just kind of going into it blind the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because your impulse is to play it as a video game, you know? And so something hideous pops up. And some of the character designs are kind of gross looking in a good way.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously you don't want to kill the adorable dog in night armor.
That's what I mean. Like, they throw you Toriel first, who's this very, like, unthreatening looking cow lady. But so then, it gives you an easy start, but then you get these real monsters. You
yeah,
know,
you get these Undyne, like one-eyed.
Yeah, Undyne is scary looking. But then
I'm
you
even talking about
that,
like your like everyday, like your normal random battle monsters. It's way easier to kill them. They're gross looking, and you're just kind of conditioned like, oh, I get this fight. You know,
right?
And the kind of the revelation that if you give every enemy the chance, they have like fears and insecurities and personalities. It's
and,
really
and
kind of
some
revolutionary.
Of them are very fun and silly. Like there's characters where you like if you compliment their hat they're wearing enough, they'll like get closer to you, and then you can take their hat and they'll run away and get scared. Or like or like there's one that's really muscular, and if you get in a flexing contest with it, it'll get so excited that it'll stop fighting you. Like those kinds of things are just very like funny and silly to me.
Or one of them is only angry because his nature is to imitate whatever he's next to. So as soon as you resolve or get rid of whatever's next to him, he's fine. Like he doesn't care, you know?
Yeah. By the way, there's always like four or five options for each of these characters, and you have to kind of figure them out. So they are puzzles. It's not just like there's a button that says fight and a button that says don't fight. Like there's a lot to this. Plus, whether you're fighting or not, you always have to play defense with that kind of heart dodging thing that you were talking about. So that ends up becoming more the central component. In fact, I would argue that fighting is kind of boring. Like you're really just hitting the fight button and then that's kind of it. There's not as much skill involved in that side of things. So it doesn't ask you to, it doesn't feel like you're missing anything either way. You know, like, it doesn't, I don't know. I really, really like this game, man. I thought it was
great.
I do too.
I'm glad that, doing this, as a subject for the podcast got me to actually finish it.
Yeah. How old is it? When did it come out originally?
I think it's like 3 or 4 years old.
Highly recommend. Really, really, really recommend this. I like it a lot. I think we ran out of things to say about it, though. Is there anything else you wanna say about Undertale?
No, I would say I'd recommend it to just about anyone.
I recommend it too. I will say it does. From what I've seen, it plays very differently if you're playing very violently. In fact, some of the scenes that I watched the genocidal playthrough. Bum me out. you can play. I mean, you're basically playing as a villain if you play that way.
Can't. You can't accidentally play the genocidal playthrough. You have to. You have to deliberately try to kill literally everything.
I mean, the one I remember is there's this cute little kid monster following you around, and there's a point where you can decide to just try to kill it. And you kind of have to do that to do the playthrough genocidal style as well. It's a bummer. I don't know if I want to play through that way, but I definitely want to try to play the true pacifist one.
Yeah, it's great. It's really good. All right, man.
All right. Well, I think, do we want to talk about what we're going to try to do next time?
Yeah. Well, we mentioned, I've at least offhandedly mentioned a couple times in this episode that this is going to be the last episode of You're Wrong with me and Bobby.
Yeah. We've been threatening this for a while, and I think it's time for the rebrand. We get along too well, and we don't argue as much as we'd like for the basic premise of the show. So I think we're gonna shift things around a little bit coming up here.
And I think you and I had talked. We aren't quite sure what it means yet, but we want to kind of add a little more structure. How we talk. So it'll be probably an experiment for a few months, but we will definitely we're going to keep the same feed, I think. If we don't, we'll post a podcast saying to follow the new feed.
What are we going to talk about next time?
We are going to talk about a show that I have, a CW show that I've adored for a long time, and Ian's finally on board. We're going to be talking about Riverdale.
fuck you.
What are we going to be talking about, Ian?
We're going to be talking about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which I have seen the first season of a couple of times. I never finished the first season, not because of quality, but because that was a show. I watched a few episodes. I really liked it, and I tried to get other people into it with me, and it just didn't resonate with the people I tried to show it to. So I kind of, you know, got distracted and found other things, but I've been meaning to go back to it forever. The show just ended, and I am powering through this show. I mean, you know me, I watch a lot of television, but I I mean, it's embarrassing. I would say I've watched maybe 3.5 seasons of this in like 2 or 3 weeks. It's going really, really fast.
Yeah.
And I'm in love with this show. I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen in my life. I think this might be a something that it's going to have to knock some stuff out of the top 10 for me in terms of television. I don't want to talk about it too much yet. We've probably already been texting about it too much and burned through most of our conversations. But by the time we record next, we will have both seen the entirety of the show. So we're going to be talking about it kind of soup to nuts from start to finish. So if you have any interest in musical comedy at all, or you know, awkward, realistic looks at interpersonal relationships and dynamics, check out Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It is incredibly, incredibly impressive in a lot of different ways that I'm excited to talk about. So I think that's why we kind of decided to do the rebrand. You know, this is something we both feel like we could talk about a lot and say a lot of things about. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to kind of take things in a new direction. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. If we end up being lazy and don't have a new theme song, I think we should shame ourselves and pick just like a really terrible pop song or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Oh no, we're gonna do it. This is. We've been threatening this for months. We got to finally, finally do something about making our podcast what we want it to be. So I believe in us, Bobby. We got 3 weeks to figure it out.
All right.
All right, man.
Well, for the last time,
yeah.
Let's have our theme song play us out. I'm getting emotional.
I know. It's very sad. Thank you all for listening to this experiment as long as it's been going on, and we hope you will enjoy the changes to come. So,
and until then,
you're